Cinephile. Nicolas Cage.
Very sincere group of film enthusiasts who are proudly cinephiles.
Oh my goodness! Warren Beatty apparently read the wrong name. This is incredible! Moonlight won Best Picture!
Cinephile. Ethan Hawke.
It's kind of like I'm a professional actor and I direct for love. There's so much in this world that's dividing us, and music is one of those great tools that brings us together.
Paul Rudd.
There's baseball and World War II. It's kind of a dream.
Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
All right, yes. Why wasn't I still recording?
That would have been gold. I'm gonna run that as the open.
It's a light, warm story that's punctuated by the power of Redford's smile, one of the best special effects in movie history. That's from Adam Graham of the Detroit News. He's talking about the new film called The Old Man and the Gun. Robert Redford says it's going to be his final acting performance. I'll review that movie along with mid-90s, a directorial debut of one Jonah Hill. And also have Rick Pastor's review of Halloween, which we're all fired to see since he's a horror movie aficionado, so... If Ricky gives it the seal of approval, that's a good thing. Thanks, as always, for checking out Cinephile with Dan Stanzik, Rick Passmore. I'm Adnan Virk, and, of course, our friend Ben Lyons is always a contributor. And Ben is very busy right now, so I want to start with this. In Search of Greatness is a documentary that he is the executive producer of. It's opening in theaters this Friday, November 2nd. Go to insearchofgreatness.com, and that's where you can purchase tickets for this documentary. It's from Gabe Polsky, and particularly for sports fans, you'll enjoy it because it's a focus on what makes a great athlete. And Wayne Gretzky, Pele, and Jerry Rice are the athletes featured. We're hoping to get Gabe Polsky on the podcast next time around, and then I'll give a more in-depth review of the documentary. But it's excellent, and you can check it out, insearchofgreatness.com. With that, we launch in. Old Man of the Gun, Robert, oh, by the way, excuse me, of course, on iTunes is where you can check us out. Give the podcast a rating out of 5 stars. I rank my movies out of 4 Maple Leafs. I haven't checked recently, but I'm sure the reviews are there, and really that helps us functioning here. So we appreciate all the love and support. Old Man of the Gun, Robert Redford. Quite simply, if you like Robert Redford, you like the movie. If you don't like Robert Redford, you're not going to like the movie. If you're kind of meh on Robert Redford, you'll kind of be meh on the movie. It's a story of a guy named Forrest Tucker. It's based on a true story. He was a criminal who had a reputation for being a really nice guy. He would walk in with a briefcase and a smile and a fedora. He would ask to see the manager. The manager would appear with a smile. He would say, hey, I'm going to need to speak to you about something. Open up his jacket, show his gun. Eventually, the bank manager would be kind of jolted. He would smile, reassure them everything's fine. Just put all your money in this briefcase. I'm going to go. And he ended up getting a reputation for being a guy who pulled off the string of heists. And after being caught by the authorities in San Quentin, would honestly find various ways to escape. So Detective John Hunt is on his tail. We got a little cat and mouse game. That's played by Casey Affleck, the Academy Award winner. His first performance since Manchester by the Sea. And Sissy Spacek plays the love interest of Redford's. And they have a really nice chemistry to them as well. Danny Glover and Tom Waits are also in the movie, which caught me by surprise. Haven't seen those guys in a while. But they play Redford's accomplices. So honestly, it's a light... a breezy thriller. There's not a whole ton of backstory to it, but Robert Redford is one of the great American actors of the last 50 years, and it's a pleasure just to see him on the big screen again. So, as I said, if you're a fan of his work, and I've talked previously on Actors Showcase about Redford and where movies like The Sting rank, and more recent movies like All Is Lost, and entertaining movies like Sneakers, or The Last Castle, I suppose. Drew Brooks, a big fan. Gandolfini. You should check it out. But honestly, there's not a whole lot to it. It's a very nice, breezy entertainment. And it's well done. Affleck, he kind of just phones it in, to be honest with you. If you're watching the movie for Casey Affleck, you should go watch Gone Baby Gone instead.
Can we get some Maple Leafs out of you here before you continue to besmirch my guy, Casey Affleck?
I'll give it 2.5 Maple Leafs. With the strong caveat of, if you love Redford, then you'll love the movie. I like Redford. I enjoyed it. If you don't like Redford, trust me, this is a hard pass. The next movie to recommend, or at least discuss, is mid-90s. And this is directed by Jonah Hill. Yes, that Jonah Hill wrote and directed it. And it's about a group of 13, 14-year-olds who are living with a turbulent home life. I guess we'd call them truants back in the day. It's 1990s Los Angeles, and they're just a bunch of skaters. They're out there having a good time, smoking cigarettes, smoking weed, trying to score some booze, hanging out at the local skate shop, insulting each other, making fun of each other, using a very popular gay slur back at that time. And that's essentially the film. And I guess if those who liked it would point to the fact that it feels authentic and realistic, and this is the way kids talk, and especially kids of that age. I mean, you definitely feel like you're watching a movie from the mid-90s, then it has that sense of place. Having said that, I didn't like the film because I just thought it was one note. I mean, it's essentially a bunch of kids who I never want to hang out with, and when I was their age, I wasn't one of them, so I didn't like these people anyways. who the hell wants to hang out with a bunch of 14-year-old skateboarders? And like I said, they're just crass and profane and bullying to others and just not the kind of people I want to spend time with in life and certainly not on the screen. So I'm already, you know, I have a disconnect to them and I just have no interest in appealing to them. It's not to say every character has to be relatable, but there has to be some element of sympathy. And I just did not get that with these guys. The main character is actually a real life skateboarder, Sonny Suljic, and they try to build a relationship with him and his older brother, Lucas Hedges, also from Manchester by the Sea. But Hedges just comes across as like a one note bullying older brother. And I just didn't really care for his character or his performance. So I give Jonah Hill credit for the fact he's obviously made a movie important to him. Maybe this movie was he in the movie, or maybe he knew people like that, and he's been out there trying to promote it. But for me, it didn't work. It kind of reminded me of the film Kids, remember the Larry Clark film back in 1995 with these just, you know, revolting characters doing these terrible things. I wouldn't say mid-90s is a Kids for 2018, but in that vein of dislikable characters where adolescents and treat people like crap and don't really care about the repercussions. So that's mid-90s.
Is it funny?
There's moments of it, but I found the humor was kind of mean-spirited. So that's why I wasn't even appreciating it. The humor is done with mockery and making fun of other characters. I'm like, you know what? I just don't really kind of find
it. Sounds like you're saying Jonah Hill stick to acting, Ben Affleck stick to directing.
Yeah, exactly. Both of you guys know your sweet spots, so stick to where they're best. I'm going to give mid-90s 1.5 Maple Leafs. The next movie, and trust me, we're getting to Passmore's Halloween in just a minute, is Wildlife, that's directed by Paul Dano. Speaking of actors turned directors. And this is a story about a marriage in crisis back in the 1960s. Jake Gyllenhaal plays the dad who is recently unemployed and is looking for work and decides to go fight some wildfires, leaving his wife, played by Carey Mulligan, who is absolutely a Dan Stanzik favorite. So she is obviously very upset that why he's leaving, and he's doing it for like $1 an hour, like some terrible pittance to go obviously risk your life fighting fires. But he just feels this quest and this mission to go do it and ends up leaving his wife and his child. So the movie then ends up focusing on Carey Mulligan and her character. And I realize as I'm watching it that this is kind of making a statement for female independence of that age and how like a lot of, you know, working women or middle class women ended up being left to their own devices and had to kind of try to find their own way. And so the character, who I don't know if it's based on Paul Dano as a kid or where he got the influence of, but Ed Oxenbould plays the kid. He's a 14-year-old. So the focus is on Ed and his mom, Carey Mulligan, as now they're navigating life without their dad, Jake Gyllenhaal, who's out there fighting wildfires. And Carey Mulligan ends up falling in love with Bill Camp, who I love because he was in The Night Of. He played the cop in The Night Of. God, he's great in that show. So the story becomes about this family in crisis, and eventually Gyllenhaal returns. And now the story becomes, okay, what's going to happen once dad returns? Can dad keep this family together, or has the family been fractured? So as a domestic story, I can certainly appreciate what Paul Dano is searching for. I thought he needed a little bit more oomph overall, particularly in the climax. I would have liked a little more resolution, but I did think there were good performances. It's like Sundance 101. It's one of your indie movies that you know does well on the festival circuit. So I'll give it 2.5 Maple Leafs for Wildlife from Paul Dano, currently playing in select theaters, starring Carey Mulligan and Jake Gyllenhaal. Lastly, I want to talk about this Jim Carrey show called Kidding, which is on Showtime. So I love Jim Carrey. I think he's one of the great actors of our time. Not just great comedic actors. I think he should have been robbed of Academy Award nominations, for The Truman Show or Eternal Sunshine, or even, he played Andy Kaufman, Man on the Moon. Even his comedic roles. Like, God, why can't a comedic actor get nominated for Best Actor? So Jim Carrey's back, which is a great thing to see because he's been very busy with his paintings and doing these kind of political commentary. So he's back doing a show, and talk about Mr. Rogers being everywhere. The character is based on a Mr. Rogers type, and the conceit of the show is this. Imagine if you're a kid's talk show host, but you're somebody who's actually dealing with a lot of pain in your own life. So on screen, you are full of sunshine and you're radiating positivity for young kids, but off camera, you're depressed, and he's dealing with the fact he lost one of his twin sons in a car accident. And he's divorced from his estranged wife. He's trying to repair that relationship. And his dad, played by Frank Langella, is the one who's the executive producer of the show. Love Langella, Frost Nixon. And Catherine Keener plays his sister, who also works on the show. Another great indie actress. And it sounds like it has all the elements here, and it's definitely strange and weird. And Michelle Gondry was involved from Eternal Sunshine. I believe he's the executive producer of the show. But honestly, I'm punting on the show after 7 episodes because it's just too strange and too irreverent. And honestly, it's too dreary. The show ends up being, moments of him being as the kids' talk show host, but then off camera, like, it's just, it's a drag watching this. And I give Jim Craig credit for saying, listen, I'm going to play a character who is suffering through this real malaise. And he's such a good character and a good actor that he does bring it to life. But it's one of those movies that are scary TV shows that's just so downbeat. I need a little bit more. What are the plot devices? He's falling in love, and he's in love with a woman who's dying of cancer. And like he's literally with her because she's like, well, I have 3 weeks to live. And he's like such a good guy. He wants to always be a good person to everybody. That ends up sleeping with her, and they're having this relationship as she's dying. And I'm like, you know what? I don't want to spend 30 minutes every week on Showtime watching Jim Carrey in this relationship. There's also one scene. Catherine Keener's husband is the daughter is taking piano lessons. The dad drops the daughter off piano lessons. The daughter looks at the window and sees her piano teacher and her father engaging in a sexual act, which leads to the most memorable line of the 7 episodes that I watched of Kidding, which was when Catherine Keener approaches the piano teacher and says, did you hand my husband? Which is an expression I had never heard before. I'm familiar with hand jobs, but that's the only time I've ever heard it before. That line alone almost made the 7 episodes worth watching. And there's definitely some moments of humor, but overall, I'm going to give Kidding 2 Maple Leafs. I just can't get through it, but I love seeing Jim Carrey, and if you love Jim Carrey, maybe you should check it out. Rick Passmore, Halloween, let's do this.
I had to go see this twice. After the first screening on Thursday, I sat there, and I loved it. I loved the initial screening. I love the fact that it's very true to the roots of what Carpenter and Deborah Hill did 40 years ago. Jamie Lee Curtis might be her best performance of her career, which is saying something because she's been in a lot of fantastic roles.
Fish Called Wanda would like
Fish Called Wanda. True Lies.
True Lies.
Brilliant.
Are you kidding? The strip scene? My God.
But I was sitting there thinking about it, and there's a lot of tonal beats that it shares with the original, which happens in remakes or reboots and different things, new sequels and stuff like that. However, on the second viewing, because I am seeing some of the turns already and things that happen, it kind of took away from it a little bit. It definitely does not have the rewatchability of the original. It doesn't have the rewatchability of some of the sequels, just in terms of just general enjoyment of just bad filmmaking. So it kind of falls in this weird gray area of being a really good film, but not one that I would probably go back and watch multiple times. And now, grant, I'm going to buy the Blu-ray when it comes out. I'm a Halloween fan. I want to support what David Gordon Green and Danny McBride wrote. I thought they made an excellent script that has a lot of subtext with victimhood and surviving, and especially with the Me Too era. There's a little scene when Jamie Lee Curtis, it's been pretty played up at this point in commentary and dissection, but when the two journalists / podcasters are trying to goat her into information, and she's pretty much done with it, and they offer her $3,000, and she just goes, all right, time's up, I'll accept my payment, and just stands there looking out the window with her hand out, like she's like, get the hell out of my house. So there's a lot of nuance in it, and there's a lot of very blatant references to things going on and very, you know, political pro-feminist statements in it. But at the same time, that's also what Deborah Hill wrote in 78 when they wrote the original Halloween. She wrote honest characters, and that's something that's been talked about for the last 4 decades, is how well written the women were. They weren't just bimbos and whatnot just to be there like they became in future horror films.
How scary is it? That's what I want to know.
Hang on. To Dan's point, I was about to say, these movies are either, especially horror movies now, are just really scary, or they're scary and funny with like a tongue-in-cheek wink wink. Which one is this?
Get that one out of here, by the way.
Yeah.
It's not that scary. If you're attuned to horror films,
yeah,
and especially, that was one of the gripes I've had told to me by friends of mine that are big horror movie fans and stuff like that. They're saying how not scary it is. I'm like, but at the same time, it's doing a lot of what Carpenter and Hill did back 40 years ago. You watch Halloween now, it's the idea of it is scary. The idea of this emotionless shape stalking you, coming after you with no regard and just no, you can't stop him. That's the fear. It has a few jump scares and it has a few really solid, brutal death scenes. I won't say who the character is that gets this, but Michael Myers does a nice little head stomp, and sorry, Dan, you're going to censor this out too, but I heard on a interview with Danny McBride. He said he wrote this in the first draft of the script and he kept it in the final draft of the script. Michael puts his foot down and brain out of his head. And he said it's still in the final draft of the script, and that's what they went with. And that is true. It is much, much gorier than the original.
Uh-huh.
But in today's standards, it's very tame. A lot of the stuff that you saw in the trailer, another big gripe for me is how trailers reveal too much. And this one does that with the jump scares. But the story is fantastic. It's extremely well written. Jamie Lee Curtis's performance is fantastic.
So it's not satirical. Like, it's not like Scream.
No, it's not satirical like Scream, because I think it's more playing on
the original
current politics. Not really politics as much as just the mindset of how we are as a society. Mm. Blaming victims and trying to understand monsters. As opposed to just letting monsters be monsters and trying to get help for victims. I mean, this is a Laurie Strode that spent 40 years without any kind of psychological help. She just went back to school the day after all this stuff happened. There is no Halloween 2 here. So she is someone that's become a doomsday prepper. Her house is a complete, like, lockdown fortress. And she's got a ton of guns. It's very weirdly pro-Second Amendment in the terms of what it's supposed to be for defense. Mm-hmm. And, but she's got... None of the guns are used aggressively. Everything is meant to be self-defense, and she's having this moment where the biggest moment she has is, let's say, about 20 minutes into the film. She's sitting out in her truck outside of the facility where Michael's going to be transferred,
mm-hmm.
and the bus rolls out, and she's just trembling and shaking, and she grabs this. She's got an alcohol problem, and she just grabs this shooter of vodka and shakingly chugs it down and is on the fringe of tears, holding a revolver in her lap, and watches the bus go by, and she just has a breakdown. You don't know what she's doing, whether she's going to hurt herself, whether she's going after the bus. But then you kind of figure out later in the film, you figure, like, maybe she was going to just damn the consequences. I'm taking Michael out. He needs to die, because that's been her whole thing. Like he needs to die. He shouldn't be alive. He shouldn't be any of this. So overall, giving it 3 Maple Leafs, 3 stars. It was 3.5 when I first saw it, but after the repeat viewing, and then so there's some things that were really I did take umbrage with how they were setting up character development, how they played their homages. I thought there were some really good homages in it with the Halloween 3 and like all the kids wearing the silver shamrock masks, but I also thought there were some connections to other films, and especially with one character in particular. If you see the film, you'll figure out who I'm talking about. But they definitely play him as kind of a projection of the Rob Zombie Halloweens.
Mm.
Because I feel that this character is basically the same as a character in the original, but he's a lot dirtier, and you don't really quite trust him. And by the end of his arc, you'll understand why.
Halloween. 3 Maple Leafs from Rick Passmore, Old Man Under the Gun, 2.5, Wildlife, 2.5, Mid-90s, 1.5, and Kidding, 2 Maple Leafs. That's a recap, and now it's time for Mike Golick Jr., a special guest review of Mandy. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. They strive to make financial services work for everyone, not just the wealthy. Non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers to invest for the first time with true confidence. Simple and intuitive, clear design with data presented in an easy-to-digest way. You know, honestly, look at the cost and no commission fees. Other brokers charge up to $10 for every trade, but Robinhood doesn't charge commission fees. Trade stocks and keep all of your profits. It's also easy to understand charts and market data. You can place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. And you can learn how to invest as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks and track favorite companies with personalized news feed. Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. Sign up at cinephile.robinhood.com. That's cinephile.robinhood.com. All right, at long last, we've been teasing this. Michael Jr. making his debut appearance here on Cinephile. You are a cinephile and somebody who saw the movie Mandy, starring Nicolas Cage, which I recently reviewed. I want your unadulterated thoughts on this Nick Cage film.
It was everything that you guys billed it to me. So when I asked the Cinephile podcast crew about this movie, so the first hour, a little so, second half, everything that you would expect, and it did. There was a certain cutoff point where in the first hour, I gained nothing from the characters actually being on screen. Mm-hmm. It was basically from the introduction of the whole crew in the van, they see Mandy. From there on, you've got a movie. Because mm-hmm. once I get to that, you know, everything that happened, once they, you know, this ragtag, you know, maniac group of bikers invades the house and all that stuff. And really, for me, life began at the Cheddar Goblins commercial. For me, that was where it all started. So from there on out, it was an absolute acid trip that I loved to death.
Describe for people the Cheddar Goblins commercial, what exactly that entails. Because this may help people go see the movie.
So Cheddar Goblins is essentially the movie's brand of mac and cheese of choice that plays on the TV that was not often used in this house. Like, we never really saw this thing on, except in this moment after some of the most grotesque horror known to man. He walks inside and the first thing he sees are on the commercial, it's just a goblin on the screen vomiting macaroni and cheese all over these children who are ecstatic. They are overjoyed to have this mac and cheese belched up on their faces. Right. And I just thought, like, wow, real life needs more Cheddar Goblin commercials.
There's been a half a dozen great Nick Cage moments. Spurting over his face, over the top, glee in his face. Like, I mean, if that was the Nick Cage we got, like Mike Ryan, our buddy from the Levitard Show, I don't know if he's seen Mandy, but I feel like one of us should text Mike and say, listen, you should watch this, but pick it up at like the 45-minute mark.
I feel like he would appreciate that, the bathroom shouting scene as he's, you know, just chugging vodka and throwing it in his wounds, screaming into the camera. Sure. And then for me, when he goes just full, like Nicolas Cage is all that is man in this movie. Right. He's an outdoorsman. He's chopping down trees in the beginning. Yeah. And then you get him in the forge. He's a blacksmith. He's forging his own instrument of death to go exact revenge on this group of mutant bikers. He crafts the most elaborate death scythe I've ever seen. That part was all masterful. Like, just him, just this raw, gritty, sweaty, blood-covered man.
Mike Golic Jr., follow him on Twitter, mgolicjr57. Please do us a favor. When we tweet out this link to promote your appearance, just include the hashtag Cheddar Goblins.
All day.
Your home is important. That's why GEICO helps make it easy to save on homeowners insurance. Because home is more than just a place. Home is where you have a cute little reading nook for those rainy days when you want to curl up with a good book, but you don't even read, so you just sit in there during thunderstorms and scroll through memes on your phone and laugh in the darkness. The GEICO Insurance Agency could help protect the dark, meme-filled corner you call home. Call GEICO and see how easy it is to switch and save on homeowners insurance.
You're listening to Cinephile, the Adnan Virk movie podcast, and a real thrill to bring in Ben Foster. His film is called Leave No Trace. He's also been in great films like Hell or High Water, The Messenger, 310 to Yuma, and others. Ben, thanks so much for the time today.
Glad to be here.
Leave No Trace. You know, the first thing I stuck out to me was Deborah Granik's made another movie. Hallelujah. She did Winter's Bone, which put Jennifer Lawrence on the map, and she's a terrific writer and director, and it was so good to see you and her teaming up in this movie, which, again, focuses on the environment and a very elemental style. What was it that attracted you to the movie, and what was it like working with Deborah?
Well, to your point, I was a big fan of Deborah's, and before her work in Winter's Bone, the film Down to the Bone with Vera Farmiga that deals with addiction, it was just a knockout. Knowing that she only makes a film every 5-7 years, this was an exciting read. But what really, I guess, just tore me up was I didn't know what it was about when I read it. My wife and I had just found out that we were having a daughter. So the story is about a father and daughter saying goodbye in many ways. So I felt pretty tenderized to a story about parenthood.
Yeah, speaking of that, I was watching the film, and my wife said to me, well, Ben Fox, he's way too young to be a dad for Thomas and Mackenzie, who plays your daughter in the film. And I said, well, this guy is a veteran. You never know, people have kids at a younger time, and especially with their set. I just love the chemistry you had with her, and you obviously had a real paternal sense of that. But I agree with her point that you're a young guy to be a dad. So how did you kind of develop that chemistry with Thomas and be this father to her in the movie?
Well, you know how the birds and the bees work. It ain't necessarily when it's that age. So if she was playing around 14, you know, you can do the math. I just turned 38 yesterday, so it's conceivable.
You look good for your age, Ben. Look at it that way.
I appreciate it. But the connection with Tom, she's just a great actor, and her light is still on. You know, you look her in the eye, and you can see that her light is on. So that was such a, it's just a joy to work with that kind of, you know, actor. And we went into the woods and we did a primitive skills training and learned to do all those, the survival elements practically. And you do enough of those tasks with somebody, you're either going to get along or not. And we happen to get along quite well.
That goes seamlessly into my next question, Ben, which is the preparation for the role. You're playing a guy, a veteran who suffers from PTSD. He and his daughter are homeless to our eyes, but in his eyes, this is the world that he wants to live in. He does not want to be in a home. He does not want to live in an urban center. He wants to live in a forest, and he's going to just forage and have this bond with his daughter, and that's it. So did you go like all Daniel Day-Lewis and like live in a cabin for a year? How did you approach the role?
We had the opportunity to work with a primitive skills coach, Dr. Nicole Apollyon out of Portland, and she specializes in these skills, these primitive skills. And that, if I can do it physically, if I can do the job physically, then I don't have to think about it when the camera's rolling. And if I don't have to think about it, something's felt, camera picks it up, and that's usually when it starts to get good.
That's a terrific performance, and you give a really good performance in the movie. Leave No Trace is the film. I encourage people to check it out. Hell or High Water is a great film, man. God, we love that movie here at ESPN. 4 Oscar nominations. You won an Independent Spirit Award for your performance. Chris Pine playing your brother in the movie. David McKenzie directed it. Taylor Sheridan wrote it. Jeff Bridges, obviously, so memorable in it. How were you able to play that character and play it so well?
Well, I'm so glad you dug it. I read the script. I knew what he looked like. Knew what he sounded like. So much of that is a tribute to Taylor Sheridan, the writer. It's that man just leapt off the page, and there are just some things that just make sense, and that guy made a lot of sense. And that's probably not a healthy thing to admit, but it's the truth.
As far as working with Chris and Japanese stories from the set, what was it like to work with those guys? I know it's set in West Texas. I'm not sure where you shot it. What was it like being out there with those guys?
A hoot. I mean, Jeff Bridges is exactly the guy you want him to be. He's super smart, wild imagination, and he's like playing music on set with his guitar. Pine is one of my favorite people to hang out and work with. That was our second film that we did back to back, actually. He's great. It was shooting guns and drinking beer and raising hell, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, there's no way around it.
Did you ever get Bridges to do like some Big Lebowski? Is that just something you wouldn't do as an actor? Did you just say, oh, what the hell? Let me just ask him to do a little bit of the dude.
I you know, I'm not going to ask, but if somebody does and I'm in earshot, I'll be very grateful.
Ben Foster's who we're talking to right now in Cinephile. His film is called Leave No Trace. A movie that I loved of yours is called The Messenger. I wish more people had seen it. With Woody Harrelson, he was nominated for an Academy Award, but God, I thought you guys were both fantastic in that movie, and dealt with a part of service I don't think enough people realize. For those who haven't seen the movie, you know, you and Woody play a couple of guys who have to go to the homes of families and inform them that their son has died in military duty, and I said, what a grueling job you have to do, and especially your character is just so, you know, just so difficulty dealing with it. But I remember that scene where Woody finally loses it at the end. It was such a powerful movie. Tell me about The Messenger.
Well, getting to work with Oren Moverman was a joy. He's the writer-director of The Messenger and Rampart and The Dinner, Time Out of Mind. He's a true auteur, and getting to ask those questions with him was a privilege. You know, we all get that call that a loved one's gone, and we all make that call at some point. If we live long enough, that's part of this experience. And that being someone's job, and it's someone's job, a casualty notification officer, that's what it's called. You go and you knock on a door. and you tell a parent or a brother or a lover or that their person's gone. And the cost of that is a part of war that we never discuss. We look at numbers, statistics, but that's a human-to-human relations job, and just so much respect for our military and those that serve, and we don't even understand, most of us don't understand the depth to which the men and women serve our country.
Yeah, it's a very, I appreciate those thoughts and echo those sentiments. It's a very moving film. What was it like working with Woody Harrelson?
Oh, he's the best. He's Woody. He's just, yeah, I don't know what to, I mean, we've done a few gigs together, and yeah. The same. There are good folks making good things, and that's heartening in a time of, or in a world of celebrity nonsense. Jeff Bridges, Woody Harrelson, these are amazing artists and humans that care about humans. It's, you know, couldn't ask for anything more.
I don't know how much you pay attention, Ben, to critics. I know most actors just want to focus on the work, and I totally understand that, respect that. But this quote, I think, is interesting from Matt Zoller-Seist, who's a critic I really like. He said, Ben Foster is one of those actors who makes even a bad film worth seeing. Sometimes he suggests the film you'd rather be watching. I think it's a compliment, although I'm not totally sure. What's your reaction to that quote?
Well, I'd say that I'm glad that he enjoys watching some of the films that I've been in, and I probably would agree with him on certain cases where I had wished that one might have been made differently. But you can't, my department is one department, and it's a big collaboration, and no apologies and no excuses. I like making things about people and with people, and some work, some don't.
No doubt about it.
Leave No Trace works.
Yeah, and yeah. I'm focusing on like these smaller films, right? Leave No Trace and The Messenger, or Hell or High Water. But you've made some big, big movies. X-Men, The Last Stand, The Punisher. How does that experience compare when you're making these big budget popcorn movies to these smaller, more intimate films?
Well, on one hand, doing a larger film just means that your props are more expensive. It doesn't mean the experience is different than make believing, and that's what we do for a living. On the downside, it's art by committee, and that can sometimes dilute perhaps the vision of a single, you know, filmmaker, which I'm just personally drawn to, you know, writer, director, filmmakers. So some are successful, some aren't. I'm a fan first. I like big, small movies. I like all of it.
One more for you, Ben, and I appreciate the time. James Mangold, you mentioned writer-directors you like. I love him. And 310 to Yuma, I thought was a good Western you made with him. Tell me about working with James, because he's one of those directors who's done so many different genres, and he's really excelled in all of them, I think.
James Mangold is such an amazingly talented writer-director. I have the utmost respect for him. I just saw Logan for the second time.
Love that
movie. It's so good. It's like a 70s noir. It's such a badass film. And damn it, Wolverine made me cry. I actually cried at that movie. So hats off to Mangold.
He's awesome, and so are you. 310 to Yuma, The Messenger, Hell or High Water, and Leave No Trace. Make sure people check it out. Ben Foster, thanks so much for the time, man. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Have a good one.
He's just an average man with an average life. And his reviews dictate that.
Oh, right up my alley, first and foremost. Playing to my strengths.
Dan Stanzik is...
I thought it was a little much.
Everyman.
All right, so people have been clamoring for this. We have not... Everyman has been missing an action man for the last couple of Cinephiles. He's now back with a bang. He's from... was busy on the road. He was traveling. Dan Stanzik's back.
There's two reasons I'm incapable of cheating. Want to hear them? One, if I break the rules and I get caught, I'll get kicked out of coaching. And what's the second reason? I might not get caught. Blue Chips.
Yes, Nick Nolte.
The prescient 1994 film starring Nick Nolte as the beleaguered, down on his luck, frustrated, burned out, surly, foul-mouthed college basketball coach Pete Bell. Bell's Western University Dolphins program that wears blue and gold and is based in Los Angeles, so put that one together, is in the midst of a disappointing season. Bell has led Western to two national championships, but now he's on the hot seat. He's swearing left and right at his players and the officials. He even punts the ball and gets ejected early on in the film. And he's cantankerous with the media, which includes Ed O'Neill, who was at the peak of Married with Children at the time and decided to go for this serious role. After suffering the first sub-500 season of his career, Bell is under pressure to turn things around. At a meeting with his assistant coaches, which is held in the office of a sneaker company, I wish I was making this up, Bell is told that if he lands Butch McRae, played by Penny Hardaway, and Ricky Rowe, he'll be in the Final Four the following season. Coach Bell hits the recruiting trail and runs into a handful of actual coaches playing themselves, including the late great Jerry Tarkanian at UNLV and Jim Boeheim, who's still coaching Syracuse 24 years later. Bell appeals to the families of the top recruits and seems to have made great inroads, but both ask for improper benefits. One's mother wants a house with a lawn and a new job, and the other's father wants a new tractor. Despite the constant cursing and ornery demeanor, Bell appears to be a man of morals and character. He scoffs at the requests by the recruits and their families, but the desire to win and return to prominence proves to be too much to quell. Bell relies on friends of the program to steer the recruits in his direction. In the meantime, he also lands an unheralded prospect from the depths of Louisiana named Neon, who is played by Shaq. And as you might expect with Penny and Shaq in the film, the basketball scenes are excellent. I would argue that they probably go on for too long, but the director, William Friedkin, hope I'm saying that right, chose to use actual basketball players because he felt that actors make for unconvincing athletes in most sports films. Along with Penny and Shaq, Bobby Hurley, Calbert Chaney, Ellen Houston, Rick Fox, and others were used. With McRae, Rowe, and Neon in the lineup, Western upsets number one ranked Indiana, coached by the legendary Bobby Knight, in the season opener. And Nolte actually shadowed Knight during Indiana's 1992 season to prepare for the role. So Bell got what he wanted, but do the ends justify the means? What means more in a game corrupted by money? Rules and integrity, or winning and success? I give the film 3 stars on its merits alone and an additional half star for being so far ahead of its time.
Blue chips. All right. I did not realize, as you said, it would be so ahead of its time. At the time, it was thought to be, you know, entertaining popcorn sports flick. Nolte's great. I love the opening. He just comes in with a crazy tirade, leads the room, comes back again. You know, these type A, crazy basketball coaches, as you said, Bobby Knight to the extreme. Dan Dawkins, we both know and love here at ESPN, says he, I don't know if he's a consultant or he's in the movie.
He may be. I was looking for Dawkins because I know he's probably an assistant coach in Indiana at the time. You may see like a shot of his hair before it was all gone.
Yeah.
But I wasn't sure if I could point him out.
Well, he was a part of the process because they told me, I think he spent a couple days with Nolte, and I said, what was he like? He goes, great guy, you know, heavy smoker, you know, he gets after it. He goes, but the biggest thing that I remember about him, I said, oh, just an amazing acting talent or just the way he would listen and observe you? He goes, no, brutal BO. Like, just, I said, that's your biggest, brutal. I said, just do it, like, just the breath. He goes, no, like, BO, he stunk. I said, just maybe the character, because he's just...
He looks disheveled well, yeah, most of the film, but...
Right. He goes, I don't know if
B.O. is like a character trait. I don't think it's... You can't act B.O. You either have or you don't.
He said, I don't know if it was method acting, but he stunk the entire time. Which reminds me, Nick Nolte's book is terrific. We've been trying to auction it off here in Cinephile. Once again, nobody has claimed it yet. The question that I asked all of you, for God's sakes, you can just Google at this point. Nick Nolte's voice, as described by Toronto Star film critic, his voice is like what? Just tell us what that is. Tweet us, Cinephile ESPN. You can have an autographed copy. No, not by Nick Nolte, by me. My autographed copy of Nick Nolte's autobiography, which dovetails nicely with Dan's revisitation of Blue Chips. The movie, I remember Penny Hardaway, right? He's homesick. He's pretty good in the movie. I thought his character was all right.
Do you think that was like a precursor to He Got Game and Spike using Ray Allen like an actual basketball player?
Absolutely. That's why I agree with you on the depression part of it, because I think... If you had to ask me to watch a basketball movie, I would immediately say He Got Game. But Blue Chips is probably better than I realize and should get credit as being the template of sorts for other basketball movies. I'm sure Spike said, you know what? Rather than get an actor to play a player, I'd rather have a player, and that's authentic. I'll nail the basketball scenes and the acting. I can just work with the guy.
I was 8 at the time, so I don't know how it was received. I remember seeing it. But was it seen as like, oh, this is what's actually happening with college basketball? Or was it seen as this like... This never goes on. Yes. This is some fantasy.
Heightened reality of what was happening. Maybe it happens in small circles, but this movie is really just taking leaps of faith with a typical Hollywoodized treatment of it. And I'm like, no, this was actually out of its time. How about Boeheim? Doesn't want to pay the players. Your guy.
Let's leave Shane Boeheim out of this. It's my guy.
Guys, at JCPenney, you can find all the great looks, whether you're in the office or on the go. Raise your game with Collection by Michael Strahan, or relax and look good on the weekend with MSX by Michael Strahan, exclusively at JCPenney. JCPenney, style and value for all.
When a film critic and director don't see eye to eye, Rick Passmore goes in defense of.
All right, Ricky, it's been a while. What do we got?
Well, ever since Leatherface and Michael Myers became indie film icons, the slasher genre has seen many antagonists to create nightmares and some insidious humor. Beyond all the reboots and retellings, canons changing and cheapening the value of films before it, one film has tackled the idea of slashers in an inventive light. And no, I'm not talking about Wes Craven's Scream. I'm talking about 2006's Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. It's a darkly comedic 96-minute meta-mockumentary that follows a titular character and his path on becoming a mass-murdering icon the likes of Freddy, Jason, and Mike, as he's referred to in the film. Leslie's played by Nathan Basil, and he takes Taylor, who's played by Angela Goethals. You know her from Home Alone, the older sister in Home Alone. She's a college journalism student inside, and she's taken inside the preparation and inner workings of his first quote-unquote job. Along with her crew of Todd and Doug, Taylor follows Leslie through his workout regimen, his studies of both human anatomy and illusion practices, and his setup for his, quote, survivor girl, the one who will create his legend. He introduces his mentor, Eugene, played by the late Scott Wilson, and his Ahab, the grizzled protagonist that will help aid the survivor girl, played by none other than Freddy Krueger himself, Robert Englund. It takes a turn when Taylor and crew realize this isn't just a silly story, but is in fact very real. When they decide to stop their project, the film switches from documentary to traditional narrative style, and I'll stop there from discussing any more plot points to avoid major spoilers. The film dissects and disrupts many of the tropes and schools of thought behind slasher films, addressing the symbolic nature of weapons, hiding, and escape, as well as the need for gratuitous sex and drug use among victims. Basil is fantastic in the role of the rookie serial killer, bringing an odd depth to the mind of a cinematic monster while also chillingly portraying such a being. While the horror genre saw a much more polished satire by Drew Goddard and Joss Whedon in 2012's Cabin in the Woods, Behind the Mask does a fantastic job of setting the groundwork for meta-horror in the new millennium, much like how Scream reset the slasher genre a decade before. Released by Anchor Bay, it sadly grossed less than $70,000 theatrically in 3 weeks, but received a cult life on home video, earning a Saturn Award nomination for Best DVD Release in 2008. Critics were favorable of its execution, with a 74% on Rotten Tomatoes, but a slightly weaker 66% on Metacritic. Fans of the genre have turned out for the film, but I still deserve it. Still feel it deserves a bigger audience, and you can watch the film right now on Amazon Prime.
I've never seen it, haven't heard of it. You had me at titular. And also, how about a thought on Robert Englund, who is Freddy Krueger? He's actually like 5'9", British accent. Like, if you ever see him in life, it's shocking, right?
Yeah, and he plays a straight man in this one. No makeup. He's only in about 4 scenes total, but just the fact he's there. And also another cameo by Kane Hodder, who played a majority of the Jason Voorhees characters in Friday the 13th, has a quick little cameo at the beginning of the film. A lot of this the film does take place in a world where all of these things have happened. Michael Myers and Freddy and Jason and Chucky, like all these like serial killers exist, and that's what it's playing on. Is like where it's not just these things have happened and they all live in their own little worlds. It's almost like a career path for some of these guys, and that's where like the Scott Wilson character Eugene comes in. Him and his wife are very kind and respectful people, even though he's a retired monster himself, and they dig him out of a sensory deprivation chamber. He's been down there for 3 days, and he's like, wow, he's like, what do you mean he's been down there for he gets up, and it's part of the ritual, it's part of the training to be able to do stuff. And they really break down a lot of these things and kind of put a little more thought into like, hey, if this is happening, here's why. And I discovered it back when I was in college, right around the time it came out, as one of those things that was just at the video store. It's like, this looks interesting, rent it for $1. And then it's become one of my favorite horror films.
Cinephile ESPN, tweet us your thoughts on that last one, because Danzy needs a studio and you have to leave. What are you dressing up as for Halloween? You're a 31-year-old man. What are you dressing up as for Halloween?
I'm a 31-year-old man with 3 different costumes I've done so far. I've been Charlie Brown. I've been Matt Foley, motivational speaker, great Chris Farley character.
Living in a van down by the river.
And I've also got Rick Sanchez from Rick and Morty, because my roommate's dog is Morty. I'm Rick. It's been 2.5 years. It finally just had to happen.
The great Rick Passmore. Thank you, brother. All right. Thanks so much to Rick Passmore for In Defense Of, Dan Stanzik for Every Man of Blue Chips, Mike Golic Jr., a guest review of Mandy, and of course, our special guest, Ben Foster. His film is called Leave No Trace. I encourage you to check it out. As we close here, I must give a big heartfelt thank you to Carlton Gillespie, who has been indispensable to us here at Cinephile. He is leaving ESPN, but Willem Dafoe, Richard Jenkins, Michael Imperioli, Robert Townsend, Mario Van Peebles, among the guests we only got because of Carlton, who is a fabulous talent producer here at ESPN. As I mentioned, he's going to go on to bigger and better, but we cannot thank him enough for what he did for our project. So, Carlton, you're the best, man. Thank you so much. We will see you next time on Cinephile Reviews. I finally got to Robert Forster. The first batch of screeners have arrived. So I got Robert Forster's film, What They Had. It was one of the first films that I got in the batch. So I cannot wait to review that. Hilary Swank, Michael Shannon, and Robert Forster. In case you haven't listened to the Robert Forster interview, I encourage you to check up Cinephile, our previous episodes, because Forster was an absolute beauty. And also, we'll talk about In Search of Greatness. Ben Lyons, executive producing that documentary. Hopefully, we'll have the documentarian Gabe Polsky with us. Until then, I'll see you at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text SUNNY to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text SUNNY to 200-300. That's SUNNY to 200-300. SUNNY to 200-300.